This week on The Inside Flap.
Writing for magazines in the beauty sector, it's a tiny little sector, which meant that I was writing about bubble bath for 15 years. Wow. So while I say I do like change now, I did manage to write about a really tiny little sector for a very long time. And I have to say, most people burned out of that sector in 2 years. But I stayed for 15 writing about shaving foam.
Like 20 feet high, and there's like this round disc. It looks like a Frisbee stuck to his wall. I'm like, what the hell is that? He said, that's an antenna. What do you mean it's an antenna?
Andrew, listen. Last week, you and I had a conversation about this. I called myself cheap. And you said, no, Laura, not cheap. Yeah. You're frugal. Mm-hmm. Cheap is when you have the money to do whatever it is, but you refuse to spend it on
something
small. Oh, so
what would
small.
That make our friend Andrew Dowd here?
I'm wondering, Andrew, if this fits your definition of cheap.
So, no. So the thing is, we have...
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the room to my 7 degrees to my right, that is shaking her head and scowling.
Howdy. Never.
No, never. Why would you do something? Rev's incomparably on the couch to my left is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
Thank you for joining us. This is episode 240 of the Inside Flap podcast, and we are happy that you are joining us. Welcome to the show. We've got a great one for you. We're joined by playwright, screenwriter, and novelist Janice Hallett, whose novels include The Appeal and The Twyford Code. Her latest book, just out now, is The Mysterious Case of the Alperton Angels. Laura and I had a really fun chat with Janice, and we'll have that for you in just a bit. But first, and of course, we've got our book recommendations and the ever-popular audiobook of the week. But first, wanted to touch upon, took a little visit over to Andrew's house.
Oh, I wonder why Andrew had a funny look in his face. You knew what was coming.
I knew this was coming.
That's really funny.
Yeah, and you know, nothing major, but you think you know a guy, you know, you've known a guy since middle school, grew up together in the Eastern Shore of Maryland, do a podcast with a guy, a weekly podcast for 5 years running, live, you know, not
fairly
too
close
far
to one another.
Away. You think you know a guy, and then you find out a few things about him that just kind of, actually one thing in particular. And again, not major.
Was it the bodies in the basement?
But, well, we'll get to what's in your basement for a second. So Andrew invited me over for, as he described it, wings, snacks, and football. I said, great. I love all three of those things. And he said, come on over Saturday. The game starts at 2:30. I said, I'm working until 3 o'clock with the kids on the set, which, by the way, is we are building not one, but two circular staircases.
Oh, my god!
Not a circle. I should say it's a bendy staircase. It goes 90 degrees. So it starts one and then goes
winding
up,
staircase.
A winding staircase.
Wow.
Yes. And she wants, of course, a winding handrail to go with it.
Oh, you're going to need a handrail.
My goodness.
So that's what we're struggling with right now. But anyway, I said, I'm working until 3, and then I'll come down, and we'll hang out. And I got so excited about these wings that I actually, well, now every Saturday, because these kids do a great job, they come in, they work hard, and they're there 9 to 3, we order lunch. So we ordered Chipotle, and I usually get myself the burrito bowl with rice and beans and the whole nine yards. I say, you know what? Andrew's got wings over at his house. I'm just going to get a salad. I'm going to get myself a nice light salad. Listen, memo to anybody who's going to go to Chipotle anytime soon. Do not order the salad. It is, I don't know what kind of, it's not romaine lettuce. I don't know what kind of lettuce it is.
Oh.
Synthetic lettuce.
And it's not spinach.
It's not iceberg?
It's not iceberg. It's like, it's got the consistency of kale. It's not kale.
I'm going to look it up.
But it's got the kind of under...
It's some sort of fast-growing, no-nutrition lettuce.
It's yeah. awful.
It's like 100% water.
It's, but it's not. I would prefer a good iceberg lettuce that's just water to this.
Oh, it's a blend.
It's terrible.
It's a
blend of poor...
you want to hear what it's a blend of?
Sure.
Romaine.
Okay, 5% romaine.
Baby kale.
Oh, I knew it. Yes, kale.
I don't like kale at all.
Yeah.
And baby spinach. I do like baby spinach.
I like baby spinach just fine, but sometimes it can be tough. This salad.
Baby spinach is not tough.
Was so, it depends what kind of baby you get. Okay. This was a very tough baby. Let me tell you something. And I think, and I suspect it's mostly kale. It was awful. And you know, kale's got that bitter
like
taste to it.
I know it's supposed to be really
tough.
Good. Do you like
it's
kale,
chewy.
Andrew?
Not particularly, no.
Yeah, it is supposed to be wonderful for you, but it doesn't mean it's good. It's awful. This salad, and I got chicken. I got the salad, the chicken, and the honey vinaigrette.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
And it was, I couldn't even eat it. I said, you know what? I'm not going to eat this because my buddy Andrew has promised me some
there's
delicious
a lot weighing
wings.
On Andrew here.
So you know.
No. Go ahead. What do you, what?
There's nothing worse than being hungry.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Ordering something.
Oh, terrible.
And then it's so bad.
Yeah.
Like you literally take a bite or two and it's just
it's
like
a terrible
I
feeling,
can't
isn't
eat
it?
This.
Right. Yeah. Well, but in the back of my mind is like, that's okay. That's okay. Because Andrew has said we got all kinds of snacks and wings over at the house. Oh, wonderful. So game starts at 2:30. I leave around 3:15. I get down to his place right around 4:00, and it's basically halftime by the time I get there. So I walk in the door and at 4:00. Now I had a donut at like 8:30 in the morning, and then two bites
of
nasty kale.
None of this is Andrew's fault.
No.
Okay.
So far.
I'm just pointing
this
out.
We're about to get to the part that's Andrew's fault, though.
I'm pointing this out right
now. I walk in the door, and you know what Andrew likes to do when he walks to our door? He likes to give the old, honey, I'm home. Mm-hmm. No, I don't do that because I have some couth.
I like it when Andrew.
No,
and then he
funny.
Greets the dog and tells the dog that he's the best dog
the
in the world.
Who's the best dog in the world? That's right.
Nelson loves it.
Yes. I walk in, and I said, all right, where are these wings? And he says, oh, well, get yourself a soda. I walk in the kitchen, and there on the kitchen are the wings. They look not very
Andrew,
appetizing.
Did you know that you were having the king
they
over?
They are, in fact, raw. They're still raw.
You didn't know you were having the king over.
There's a bunch of raw wings lying on the counter.
The king needs his meal.
Yeah, I didn't know that there was a
hot
time, a time
ready.
Line.
Well, I figure if we're sitting down watching football, you want the wings. I said, well, this is not going to be happening anytime soon. So we go down the basement.
I feel like
yes,
you
Andrew,
need to
go
let
ahead.
Andrew
go
speak.
Ahead.
My expectation also was to have the appetizers earlier.
Ah.
Right. Oh, okay.
Well, you're
okay.
watching football.
Okay.
You got to have
the wife
snacks.
And I were not on the same same page.
Okay.
And this was the early game. And she's like, I'm going to have it so the
stuff. So it's for dinner.
This stuff's finished towards the end of the first game.
Mm. Oh.
Well, see, I got a little mix up there. I was invited for the early game.
Yeah. Dave and I were on the same page. You know?
Yeah, we were on the same page.
Oh, I see now.
I see what's going on. Okay.
I see.
All right. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. So we go down. Andrew says, halftime, let's go down and play
so, but,
a little.
So hang on, though. There are plenty of snacks in my house. Like there are plenty.
Okay,
and
I did
there
not
are.
Nary. I did not nary a snack.
There are homemade oatmeal cream pies.
Oh, right. Those were amazing.
Now those were great, but I had I'm thinking I've been down to your house where there's been lovely cheeses and lovely crackers and meats. So that's the problem is in my mind. That's what I'm picturing. And the only thing that was there were these oatmeal cream homemade cookies, which are delicious. Absolutely out of this world. Katie knocks a home run with these suckers. My palate was expecting some meat and some cheeses. That's all. So we go down the basement. Now, Andrew's got in this basement, he's got on one side, he's got a little craft corner for the kids. Mm-hmm. He's got a little workout corner where he's got his treadmill. He's got his exercise bike. He's got the thing that straps you in that Robert De Niro got in Cape Fear when he gets under the gravity bending machine where you strap yourself
inversion
in.
Inversion table.
Oh,
inversion table. There you go.
My dad had that in the 80s.
You can put yourself upside down. Not sure what the point of that guy is, but.
Live forever.
He's got, and then on the other side, and then he's got a big black tarp. Halfway across the thing, and then the other side is Peter's domain, and that's where Peter's animatronics are. I mean, we've recounted that story many times, the haunted house that's on the other side that set off the fire alarm last time I was there. Well, now some of Peter's animatronics. I guess he's gotten some more because they've encroached. And Aaron's like, ah, I told Peter. The first thing he said when we get down, I told him to keep his animatronics on his side. There must be at least five or six more animatronics that have crawled and creeped their way onto Andrew's side. Andrew, what happened there?
I think these things are breeding in the basement.
They must be.
But, now, does Peter go down there and just works. Mad scientist it up?
Kinda, yeah. What's he do? Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
And he got a new one. He got a Jack in the Box that he was all excited about that he came down and showed me his new Jack in the Box, one that's got smoke and all kinds of things. Wow. So we had to make sure the door was shut so we didn't set off the smoke detector again.
It's a scary Jack in the Box. So think of Jack in the Box, but 7 foot tall.
Oh, wow.
Scary. The box is almost, it was like 40 by 40 inches. Like, it's massive. It has to have a huge compressor that runs it.
The big plywood box.
I mean, if you weren't expecting it, this thing would scare the bejesus out of you.
Wow.
That's true. So you would set it up on the sidewalk for Halloween, for sure. You're going to get someone. So we're down there. We play a little, what do you call it? What do we play? Cornhole.
Cornhole.
Cornhole down in the basement.
13 to 12.
And then I had the 13.
Nope. I had the 13. Remember? I came back. You had the
right into the microphone.
You had the 12.
Did I?
Yeah.
All right. Well, in either case, we didn't finish the game.
We can resume.
Interesting.
So I hear the TV upstairs, and I hear like shouting going on. I said, "And I think the game's back on." No, it's not. Let's play a little more. So we were playing some more. And I said, "Look, I think the second half has started. I can definitely hear the announcers going crazy. Let's go up and watch."
Are you picturing like snacks being brought out upstairs?
Absolutely.
And the game's back on.
Absolutely. Game's back
on. People shouting.
Second half is going on. There's going to be the cheese, the crackers, the wings are frying up. We're going to be good to go. I go up there and I see, or I think Katie said, Ravens touchdown. Ravens score a touchdown. So we go upstairs and I see the commercials are getting ready to start. I said, just rewind it so we can watch and see what happened in the touchdown. He said, they're gonna replay it. We don't need to rewind anything.
Oh.
I said, no, I just want to see what led up to the just rewind it. We can fast forward past the commercial later. I'm like, what's going on here? He's like, he doesn't want to rewind it for some reason. I said,
Dave loves to rewind.
What the hell is going on? Pausing, rewinding, recording every sporting event in every different sport is on my DVR right now. I said, what the hell is going on? I said, why can't we just rewind it? He said, this is live. I'm like, you didn't. Well, it doesn't matter if you're not recording it, even because it's playing.
You're trying to, like, hey, it's 2024.
It's still playing.
It's 20.
You haven't changed the channel.
Hey, old man.
We're in the 2020s.
We're not streaming it.
You
There's
can
no
still
DVR.
Rewind it. He says, no. Look at that. And he points
live,
up in his wall. He's got a wire coming from his TV up the side of the wall, like 20 feet high, and there's like this round disc. It looks like a Frisbee stuck to his wall. I'm like, what the hell is that? He said, that's an antenna. I said, what do you mean it's an antenna?
Andrew, listen. Last week, you and I had a conversation about this. I called myself cheap, and you said, no, Laura, not cheap.
Yeah.
You're frugal. Mm-hmm. Cheap is when you have the money to do whatever it is, but you refuse to spend it on something small.
What would
small.
That make our friend Andrew Dowd here?
I'm wondering, Andrew, if this fits your definition of cheap.
So, no. And so the thing is, I blame this partially on the NFL because we have a million streaming services, Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu.
We do too.
You got to have those.
Paramount.
Yeah. Sure.
Like, mm-hmm. I mean, we're probably
We've
paying
got
for
all those.
6 to 8 different streaming services.
Yeah.
Right? The problem with like the NFL this year is the NFL will stream some games. Like some of them are Prime, some of them are on Paramount. I mean, they're jumping all over the place. And this just happened to be a game that was not being
They've been what mostly
every single game is on network TV.
They've been
every
mostly
week.
On network TV
yeah.
is what
they,
I would say.
Yeah, and we just we're not paying like we cut the cord. And so we have streaming services and we have our antenna.
You don't ever watch CNN or anything like that? MSNBC?
Not really.
Fox News?
No.
TNT?
My goodness.
ESPN?
I know. Sorry, I just thought I'd throw it out there.
No ESPN?
No. I mean, we're not like we're
Nine
not,
News? Do you watch Nine News?
We do watch
news?
Nine
Local
News,
news?
But guess
they
what?
Watch it through their live
Oh, you have to watch
antenna.
It at 5
they
o'clock.
They got to watch
or
when
six,
it happens.
Whenever it happens.
Yeah. He can't even set a VCR.
Screw that, Andrew.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah. It's I'd we rather pay 50 get rid bucks of... a month for YouTube TV. It's $50 a month, and you get all the channels and it's DVR.
We watch it all the time with sports, actually.
Part of it is we are in a transition where we cut the cord. I mean, we used to pay $300 a month for DirecTV and all that BS.
Well, that DirecTV is, you don't need DirecTV anymore. You get the YouTube TV.
We cut the cord.
You said that four times.
And we've got all these streaming services. And maybe there's a smarter approach. What did you call it? Roku. Maybe there is a smarter approach. We're just not there yet. We're still in.
Yeah, they're taking their time.
We're still in month nine of the cord cutting experiment.
I will say, all these different streaming services
are ridiculous.
Amount to a big lot of nothing, but you're paying so much money for them all. Yeah. And it's kind of ridiculous.
Well, and these YouTube TVs.
Like,
and
I forget
Roku
that I
TV,
signed up for Hulu. I have no idea what's on it.
These companies now replace the cable companies because they are, again, they are a streaming service, but with YouTube TV or Roku or whatever, it's not a lot. It's not as much as the cable companies are. And what you get are all the channels and the ability to record and watch at your leisure.
Well, it's nice for us because we are sports. We watch sports.
Constantly.
Yeah.
And I can watch all my NBA teams at any time that I see fit.
That is true. Oh, is that nice. How you're watching them all? It's just with
through the YouTube TV.
Oh, I didn't know
with
they had
the, with
that.
With the sports add-on, the NBA package.
Oh, see, there you go. Okay. I wondered about that.
I got it's that time of the year. We're getting to the second half of the season.
Baseball will soon be here.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Andrew, how are you going to watch your baseball games?
Yeah, I don't really watch baseball. I'm just not that big on sports.
Mm. Well,
sports 24 hours. So if he doesn't watch sports then, that's the main reason to have the TV. I like to have the CNN, MSNBC. I like all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't watch it very often, though.
Yep.
But I like knowing it's there.
But when your Charles Barkley show on TNT.
I love my Charles Barkley show.
You got to love that.
I call it the Shaq show, though.
The Shaq show. Mm-hmm. Shaq in the
Fool. I love that show.
So that's my little update. My little head scratcher. I applaud the cord cutting. God knows we pay
too surprising.
Much.
Well, it's surprising.
Going into the Dowd household, surprised me. It took me aback.
Okay, maybe then you'd call it frugal.
Well, again, we're transitioning. This is month nine of cord cutting.
Okay.
And like we used to pay for like DirecTV where we had the DVR and all that stuff. Now we have streaming services, right? And like I said, there probably is a better implementation.
I would recommend the YouTube TV.
Yeah.
50 bucks a month.
You basically recommended that before. Katie has very particular viewing preferences, and she's the one that basically controls the content. Mostly I watch stuff on my phone.
Andrew does love watching TV on his
mostly
phone.
On my phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. All right. Interesting. We'll have to keep you guys updated on Andrew's viewing habits as the months. Maybe by month 12, he'll take a step back and take a look back, and we'll see where we are. Laura, how's your week been?
Oh, it's been good. We've had great weather. Really nice weather.
Oh, I'm sorry. I do want to add one last thing. We did get the wings served with 2 minutes to go in the game.
Were
they worth waiting for?
And wings were very good. I wasn't expecting that it was going to be like dinner. I was expecting to sit. And Andrew and I did sit on the couch while the family sat at the table. Andrew's like, no, we can eat on the couch. I said, great.
Oh, nice.
Sit on the couch.
Funny.
And the whole
the Ravens.
So I didn't realize it was dinner. I think Katie misunderstood. It was not football snacks. It was dinner for the Dowd family.
I think the problem is the plan changed that as she's sitting there thinking about it, and she's kind of like, well, hey, I'm going to kill two birds with one stone here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so Mrs. Practical.
I can get these wings on the table while the football game is still being played. Never mind, it's 31-10 and 2 minutes to go.
Oh, man.
The oatmeal cream pie sandwiches were amazing, though. So we tip
world's
the
smallest violin right here.
to Katie for that. That's right. And the sodas are, as always, a bottomless supply of sodas at the Dowd household, which I do appreciate.
There you go.
Maybe look into the 12-ounce cans next time. The 8-ounce cans.
We started buying the mini cans.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah.
You cord cutting on that?
Two sips and I'm done.
If the wife is trying to control the quantity of soda that the kids drink.
Yeah.
So that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Remember the old 2-liter bottles? Do they still make 2-liter bottles?
There was one in our fridge a few days ago. Yeah. Coca-Cola Classic.
I do not drink soda anymore, but Mr. Medicus loves his Coke.
I do. Yeah. I'm drinking a LaCroix.
I mostly drink water.
Not every day.
I drink a cup of coffee in the morning. I mostly drink water. Sometimes it's water with a touch of cranberry juice in there.
Aristocrat.
But mostly mostly that's it. I mean, I'm not a big soda drinker. I might have one soda a week, maybe. Some weeks, probably not even that.
Hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. Anyway, I'm sorry, Laura, for interrupting you.
I don't have a whole lot.
Is your week?
It's been great. We've had great weather for January. We had a terrible, terrible cold snap. And then all of a sudden, it's been like 48, 49, and it feels like 75 out there to me.
Oh, yeah, and, absolutely.
Like, it's damp and wet, and I'm like, oh, springtime's coming. I started listening to my garden podcast that I usually listen to in the spring and summer. Started up listening to that. And I've got like planting fever. So this time of year, I start to get like, oh, I'm going to order seeds. I gave up on the vegetable gardening because in Colorado, our growing season's really short.
So short.
I'm not going to get do involved with the greenhouse and the grow lights. It's not for me. So I just grow flowers now, and I really like growing flowers. So now I'm all excited about different varieties of flowers I'm going to grow this year. But I was telling Andrew, because we also have some bulbs that I know I should have planted, but I got them a little bit late.
Tell us what you like about gardening and the flowers. Like, why is the passion?
Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah.
Thank you. To start things from seed, I enjoy what's going to come up in this climate, because I don't do a whole lot of water, right? I'm trying to be careful with that.
Right.
And I like to see what's going to be able to handle it. Our climate is so, it's kind of harsh out here. We have extreme wind. We'll have hail sometimes three or four times in a summer. I mean, whatever can survive out here, I find fascinating.
You say kind of harsh. It is damn harsh.
Like, it is. Like,
what do they say typically is don't plant before Mother's Day out here.
Yeah, it's Mother's Day.
Because Mother's Day.
We'll get a huge snowstorm on Mother's Day.
Oh, yeah. We get frost and everything. It is so hard to grow anything out here.
New York grows really well. Tumbleweeds. I see tumbleweeds everywhere.
That came over from the Russian settlers.
So crazy.
Who had seeds, I guess, in their pockets.
And Russian tumbleweeds.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. But I gave up on the vegetable garden. I'm all in on flowers, and I do a lot of native stuff. And then I also like to do some annuals and things like that. Yeah. But
and you did an amazing job out front with our prairie garden.
Yeah, and I'm excited.
Came to fruition.
I got I got good feedback from the neighbors, which honestly just made me feel vindicated, which I know it shouldn't have made me feel vindicated.
After year when they would walk by and you'd see them kind of just look over, glance askance and shake their head and keep walking.
I felt so yes.
Finally got some compliments.
I felt triumphant.
Yes.
The queen is in her castle. I am here and I'm successful. Yeah, but I have a side yard that I didn't do anything with.
Oh, yeah.
Because the front yard was very overwhelming for me. And I finally like kind of nailed it. We'll see what happens this year. But I have a side yard that I'm very excited about. Ooh. That I think I'm just going to do red clover for the first year.
Oh, okay.
To get it's supposed to be really good for the soil.
Okay.
Anyway.
Fun.
Andrew, how have you been?
So generally good. So
Andrew's got some breaking news. I forgot.
Well, sort of.
He's got some breaking news.
So the thing is,
I guess I don't know.
I work for a technology company, and technology is, I would say, it's fickle.
It's a fickle mistress.
And some people, definitely. Some people work in technology that really shouldn't work in technology.
I'm sure.
They just don't get it. It's stuff is complex. All the stuff that happens, there are layers upon layers of complexity with technology. Mm. I thrive in that environment. Like, I get it. And so basically, I Monday, I'm in work, and I would say in ways some things are going good at work, some things maybe not so good.
Mm.
And so I get a meeting invite for a 15-minute meeting with HR and my boss for Monday afternoon.
That's not
is Monday afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
HR.
Is there an agenda?
And your boss.
No, there's no agenda.
Oh. It's just a talk.
Well, it says touch base.
Touch base.
Right.
Mm.
So it's like aha. Uh-oh. And so basically, and so I'm like, I'm pretty sure I know what direction this is going. So anyways.
Now, do you get a sinking feeling in your stomach, or you're not, I know you're not really excited about the job that you have right now.
No. And it's like, I won't go into that too much. So anyways, basically there's a dour face HR person who I've talked to before.
So this is over like a Zoom video?
Is it like a Toby?
Video call. But you can tell.
Yeah. It's like a Toby.
You can tell the HR person is all business, right? She has her game face on, right?
Oh, boy.
And my boss is there. And so they basically said, we are putting you on a written warning.
Oh.
Whoa, what?
And basically, and there wasn't a lot of discussion, there wasn't a lot of talk, and it's basically, we're putting you in a written warning, it's like, we've already given you a verbal warning, and it's like, well, you really haven't given me a verbal warning. My boss and I actually haven't met in a one-on-one for more, since more before Halloween.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and it's like, and so, like, and they basically say is you've got 2 weeks to improve. I'm like, okay, well.
Improve what?
Is it your attitude?
Well, and so.
No offense.
I know, I'm confused.
So no, but only because I know Andrew hasn't, he's not super enthused about.
No, right. It's not that I.
He can also be very direct.
I'm pretty positive. Yeah. I'm transparent, but I'm mm-hmm. I'm not like transparent. I'm not like rude or
no. I don't any, picture any you. Like I don't picture you being rude.
And you,
at
can
all.
You picture the, what the verbal warning was? Do can you have any recall of what the verbal warning?
No. So what it comes down to is, my boss wants me out.
Yeah.
Right. And this really comes down to her boss. 4 months ago, basically said, Andrew, what's it going to take to turn your team around? I'm like, well, I need to be able to manage my team. And so basically told my boss. Let Andrew manage the team.
Mm.
Oh.
And she is absolutely a control freak, and she needs to control everything, right? And she's a busy person. She is smart, but you can't know everything about what 150 different people are doing. Mm. And I always say with development, give me a small, engaged team. Engaged means they're informed. They know what's going on, right? Because you need to make informed decisions. So anyways... Things have started going better for the team since she wasn't involved in the day-to-day. But as soon as that change happened, her attitude towards me completely changed. Mm. And
she's a meddler. She's one of those pesky meddlers.
Micromanager?
No, I wouldn't go there. Like,
oh.
Her boss called her a micromanager.
Mm-hmm.
She thinks I said that. I'm like, I'm not the one who said those words ever.
Uh-oh.
Her boss basically called her a micromanager. And I said, no, I mean, I think the problem is she just doesn't trust people and she can't delegate. Hmm. So she has to like control. She wants to control things. So in any event, like what this letter said is bullet point number one is Andrew dealing with complex issues or complicated issues complicates them.
Oh.
What?
Yeah. And it's like,
huh?
It's like, how can I complicate something that's by its very nature
complex.
Complicated? You know, and she's basically said, Andrew, you need to make this simple. And it's like, I can't make it simple. I can manage the complexity, but I can't take something that's layers upon layers. And anyway, so like this letter doesn't say a lot. And I basically say, you know, and in the one-on-ones I had with her, she would always complain about everything. And I'd be like, well, okay. She's like, you completely mishandled that situation.
Oh,
you,
boy.
You made an absolute mess about that situation. And this is something which is a small issue where I found out about something late at night. I informed the team the next day early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, you completely mishandled the situation. I'm like, well, I found out about it. I let everybody know. I wrote up the details and let the team know, including you, at the first opportunity, you know, at a 7 a.m. meeting. I'm like, and so I ask her, what should I have done differently? I'm like, okay, what should I have done differently?
Mm-hmm.
She silent. She's like, well, you just made a complete mess of it.
Just because you're the bearer of bad news.
Well, yeah. And this wasn't even bad news. It was just simply, this was like one small little change we needed to make. But like the business basically said, you need to change code A to code B. And it's just like, you know, I mean, it's like, it's nothing.
Yeah.
But like that's the last one-on-one conversation we had, and she pretty much hung up the call.
Oh,
but I'm willing to change. It's just a question of when I ask for specifics. I mean, that's what I get, and that's the reaction I get. So, anyways, HR makes it clear we're going to meet again in 2 weeks. This stuff needs to be turned around.
Because human beings turn things around in two weeks.
Yeah, 14 days. That's all it takes.
And I ask on the call, I'm like, well, give me an example. Can you give me an example of something you don't think well?
Perfect.
Because for me, it's always like, and she calls like out this one project, basically saying, you know, oh, that project. I'm like, well, that project did everything we designed it to do, but the people who were supposed to use it didn't want to use the tool because it made certain things transparent and they didn't like that.
Mm.
And it's like, I'm like, but the tool did everything we designed it to do. like almost flawlessly without any issues. But it's like, but that's, so that's the situation. So now I'm on this 2-week written warning.
Oh, jeez.
And
you're not sure what you're supposed to change.
Well, and the thing is, there's no real plan. Like, you know, we don't even have one-on-ones anymore. HR made it clear we're going to talk again in 2 weeks. And I basically said, well, could you, you know, can we resume the one-on-one conversations and will you participate in the one-on-one conversations? Right. Absolutely not.
Oh.
Like I said, HR has their game face
so
on.
So they already know what they're going to do.
That's it. They've already made the decision.
They've made the decision.
To let me go. Yeah. This is just simply them.
Their paperwork.
And right. That's
crossing the
CYA.
T's, dotting the I's, saying, well, we had a meeting with them. Nothing changed in those 2 weeks.
That seems very unfair.
It does. And it is, but the thing with like corporations, it is what it is. I'm not going to change anything. Like, and people say, well, you know, are you going to fight? Are you going to win? It's like, what's the point? I mean, honestly, and I would say is people, you need to focus what you spend energy on. There's no point in me getting upset. Nothing's going to change.
It wasn't a dream job for you.
Well, you know, it could have been. Could have been a dream job, but you know, it could be fun what we're doing. Like what we're doing could be fun, but unfortunately, like the way the environment is, they have everybody at each other's throats. Mm. So instead of working as a team, like people are basically picking on little stuff that makes no difference whatsoever.
I have similar things like that where I'll have a job where it's me, it's an architect, it's a GC and a client. And it's usually the GC who will set the tone. And it can be very antagonistic. Mm. And it doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
The people that I like to work with, the guys that I usually work with, we're all pretty easygoing. We're there to support the client. We want to help them get their dream home or whatever they're paying us to do and have them be happy. And then there's these other jobs where you're like, why is this such a fight?
It is what it is, but it's, you know, it ends up being a relief. Like it isn't like necessarily good news. But it's a good time to make a transition.
Yeah, springtime almost. Yep. At least in my head, it's springtime. Yeah.
And Katie will be happy. You'll be able to look for a job where maybe you can actually get out of the house. So
well,
she doesn't have to.
I
want to
say the job
you.
Is I work on an East Coast time schedule.
Oh yeah,
you're which, always
a lot of people out here
terrible.
Do that.
Yep. Well,
yeah,
the thing is, and I wouldn't mind like a little bit. You know, a lot of times I'm up at 5 a.m.
Oh.
I'm at my desk by 6.
I couldn't do that.
I miss my kids getting up for school in the morning. Right, I'll come out. Sometimes I don't get out. Like I'll go in the office at 6. Sometimes I won't get out, and there's a bathroom in my office, so it might be 11 o'clock before I can actually leave my office. Sometimes it's later than that, but you know, I mean, you get into stuff and you're into stuff, and it just, you know, the next thing you know, 4 or 5 hours have gone by.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's that, and then there's the fact that I'm always working from home, and both like Katie and I said, long term, like this just isn't ideal.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what is ideal. Our conversation with Janice Hallett. A lot of fun talking to her. Her new book out is The Mysterious Case of the Alperton Angels. And Laura, you read this book. I know you really enjoyed it. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Oh, sure. So this is about a true crime journalist named Amanda who sets out to write about the Alperton Angel case, about a cult who believed they were archangels. Which is, you know, always fun.
Yeah.
And how they convinced a teenage girl that her newborn baby was the Antichrist. So the quote unquote baby is now 18. Clearly was rescued also.
Yeah.
And Amanda is tasked with trying to find this baby whose identity was hidden from the press and the public when all of this went down. So she gets kind of suckered into co-writing this with a guy named Oliver, and the paper chase to find the baby just takes off because whoever finds the baby gets the story, gets the scoop.
Okay.
So this book is told solely through text messages, emails, letters, transcripts of interviews and phone conversations. Also excerpts from fiction that was inspired by the also fictional Alperton Angels case, just in case you think this is a real case.
Right.
And some other documents. So it's an interesting way to read a thriller. I've not read one of this author's books before. And she does write different ways to tell stories.
Yeah, we got
for
into
all
that,
of her books
with her. Yeah.
Yeah, and I thought it worked really well with a true crime type of piece where you're trying to solve this mystery alongside the journalist, and you're getting bits and bobs of stuff as the journalist is getting it. So it's very engaging. It's also well over 4 stars on Goodreads right now. So bravo.
Bravo. And I know she's a big theater fan, so it was great chatting a little theater talk with her. So now, without further ado, talking about her book, The Mysterious Case, The Opportune Angels, this is Janice Hallett. This is my, so I'm a high school theater teacher, and this is my classroom.
Wow. Oh, wow.
See, we have the posters of all the plays and musicals that we've done up on the wall over the years.
That's amazing. That's fabulous. How long have you taught there?
Only at this school for about 3 years, but I've been teaching for about 20 years.
Wow.
I see that you wrote a play. I was going to ask you about that. So, you know.
Teacher, amateur drama was my big hobby, you know, for most of my life.
Was it really? Oh, that's awesome. That's
great. As an actor or a playwright or both?
Everything. And as a sort of, I joined when I was 14 and the company folded when I was 44. So 30 years. And I did everything in that time.
Did you really? That's great.
Yeah.
Can you do a soliloquy for us, please?
Oh, no, I can't. absolutely not. I only acted sort of about a third of the time.
Okay.
So that's my excuse for that.
All right. What was your favorite part of the experience? What did you enjoy the writing part the most? Oh. I know it's not the directing. Yeah. You have to put up with actors. So I know it's not that.
Oh, it's not the directing, yeah, for sure. And it's not the prompting as well. That's a pretty thankless task.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I like the acting. I like the playwriting. Everything, really. I like the whole, the fact that you become a family.
It is cool.
With the rest of the company while you're putting on a play. And that is really wonderful. That's the best part of it, I think. It
really is. And it's an underrated part. And it's not something that people understand because you get so close. Like, we were here till 9 o'clock last night working on the set. I do the technical aspect of the theater for our main stage productions. And so we were here building and then, you know, eating pizza and watching funny videos all together. So, you know, you become very, very tight knit and it's a really cool thing.
It is. And you really get close to people when you work hard with them, when you're working towards that common goal.
Exactly.
And yeah, it's something that it's difficult to describe if someone hasn't had that experience.
And then the curtain drops on the final performance and then you never see these people again. And that's the weird
thing. I know.
That's the weird
thing. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure if you're like a professional actor, I'm sure there's a sense of loss after that because there definitely is in amateur drama. And yet the good thing about that is that in a couple of weeks, you come back for the auditions for the next play. So you're with these people again.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do feel sorry for the professional actors that don't have that. And as soon as the play is over, it's gone.
Yep.
And
I know.
Alone again.
All right, you two. Enough.
Okay. All right.
Yep, we talked.
Has a book. It's I loved it. It's called The Mysterious Case of the Alperton Angels. Am I saying that Alperton correctly?
Alperton. Yep. Correct.
So this is a twisty journey told in screenplays, text messages, you know, WhatsApp, recorded transcripts, all kinds of stuff, and it's filled with anonymous tipsters, false leads, and of course, archangels, because what book not be complete, Dave, without archangels?
Right. You got to have the archangels.
Love an archangel. Janice, what inspired you to write this one?
What inspired me? Well, I would have to say my love for true crime inspired this book. I absolutely love true crime. I will be there for any podcast or book or film about a real life murder or serial killer or cult. And I love it. I love it. But at the same time, I hate myself for loving this entertainment that comes from other people's worst experiences, you know, the worst things that happen in the world. And from that dilemma comes this book, because it's a book about two true crime authors who are looking into a case from the past, or what they think is from the past, and they're getting to the bottom of a crime that happened 18 years ago. So I think I get to explore that dilemma, that early dilemma, and also look at historical crime and kind of reenact crimes for myself, because this is based around a cult. What the two authors are researching is, they're both looking for a baby they're both looking for a person who's now 18 that was a baby.
I laugh out of that because they're always like, my ankle's the baby. Where's the baby? You have the baby? And it's like, we're talking about an 18-year-old person here.
Right. That's right. And there's lots of shorthand that journalists and people who research a lot will use. So it can be quite funny because, of course, they're a bit like police officers and other people who work in these very pressure cooker environments. They get a kind of gallows humour, and they cut off from their emotions, really, or the emotions surrounding the crime, so they can look into it and get to the truth. And I think we get an element of that here, of people talking very snappily about, the baby. Who is actually a child. Because, of course, to interview this child, now they're an adult, is a huge scoop. And these are two former journalists who really want to get to the bottom of the story.
Absolutely. I love the story, but I also, I found myself just continually amazed at how the book is written. And I know you've written other books in this format where it's not a traditional narrative structure. It's incredibly impressive to read it. And it unfolds like you, the reader, are the detective too. It must be something that comes naturally to you, because it would not come naturally to me.
It comes naturally now, because this is my third novel that's been written that way. But it did happen accidentally, totally happened out of the blue, because I started writing a novel having been a screenwriter. Mm. And when I, on a whim, decided to write a novel, I used the idea that I'd been working on as a script, and that was the appeal. And it was set around a drama group who are putting on a play. And it's the emails that fly back and forth between the characters as this play is being rehearsed and eventually staged. So it became second nature to me to write people talking, which is what emails are. They're people talking to each other, communicating.
Yeah.
My second novel, slightly different, The Twyford Code, is transcriptions made by a character that can't read or write. So he's talking into his phone, and what we're reading are the automatic transcriptions that he's made. Now, this is a mixture of the two, as you've read it, so you know it's emails, text, messages, and transcriptions of interviews.
And
so
novels and screenplays.
Yeah.
I know. I don't know how I did it.
I don't know how you
mystery.
Did it either.
Complete mystery.
And then I read that you're a pantser, which means, you know, you write, you don't outline. Did you have to go back and, like, insert little... or change? I don't, it's just crazy.
Oh, yes. I had to go back, put it that way, after my first draft. There was a lot of rewriting to do, because I didn't know what it was going to be about until I got to the end of that first draft.
Wow.
I don't know if you have any writers listening to you, but yeah, I wrote the first draft completely freely, let the characters take me where they would. And yeah, then I had to get down to making my plot work, making my character, giving my characters all their proper arc that they all need. Even tiny characters that only appear two or three times need a kind of arc as well.
Yeah.
So getting back into that, that's all done afterwards. That's kind of reverse engineered.
Makes sense to flush it out, fill it out. Yeah, that makes sense.
So you get the fun part over with first, and then you really have to pull up, you know, roll up your sleeves and get to work and do the nitty gritty.
Exactly.
Is what it sounds like.
I often think if I was a plotter, I'd have that hard work first, and then I could have fun.
Yeah.
The grass is always greener, isn't it? I'm sure the plotters envy the pantsers as well.
But it is
a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
Most writers we talk to are like you. They're pantsers.
Right.
And it's the rare author who plots. I don't know how they do it either. It seems incredibly boring. Yeah.
Well, they also seem to have a little bit of a high horse they like to be on.
They do.
novel can't really be a novel unless it's... Not true. We've talked to way too many excellent authors such as yourself who have proven the opposite.
So we know like, oh, okay. Yeah, you can do it both.
Yeah. I tell the English teachers in my building all the time, these kids do not have to outline before they write. Just let them write.
Yeah. Oh, it's much more fun when you're
exactly
you're, like using your creativity and using your imagination and you don't know what's around the corner.
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. And I think sometimes, it takes all the fun out of it to know what's about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed. So you have Amanda, your protagonist in this book. She is contacted by an amateur murder club who tackles unsolved and cold cases. Now, I'm very curious about this. Did you reach out to any? Did you come across any? With the internet, everybody fancies themselves an amateur Sherlock Holmes. And I'm wondering if you came across any of them, or maybe you consider yourself to be one. I don't know.
I didn't come across any of them. I didn't consult any of them. When I always read my true crime books and watch the true crime docs, I always try. I think, right, let me get to the bottom of this. Okay, show me the evidence. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you who did this. And I always feel that way. And I thought that would be quite fun if Amanda is contacted by these people or works with these people who have no vested interest in solving the crime apart from their own delight at having done so. It's a quite fun aspect people do feel that way. You know, it's a mystery is to be solved.
Right.
Even when it's a real life mystery.
And that's why a lot of us, not me personally, but why a lot of people read mysteries, because they want to put on their detective hat. I just like the story. Do you, so you've never been in an amateur murder club, but you have been in a cult, right? No.
You'd think so. You would think
I
so.
Would, yeah.
unless you count my amateur drama group as a cult.
Absolutely. There's a lot of cult, a lot of standing in circles, a lot of deep breathing. So very cult-like.
Yeah, you're absolutely true. So maybe.
Okay, all right.
But yeah, no, I'm fascinated by cults as well.
Yeah, they are fascinating.
They're just really fascinating phenomenons. They're phenomenons of psychology. Mm-hmm. And that's what I love about that.
Did you do any research on cults for this book?
I was really lucky. I mean, one, I've read it all. I've read everything about every cult anyway. Yeah. But while I was writing this book, the whole NXIVM thing was in the press.
Oh,
and loads of documentaries and shows were coming up. I was really lucky in that respect because I got to see the cult leader on screen, which you don't really often do.
Right.
Most of them are not filmed, but the leader of NXIVM was. And I got to watch him. And it's amazing to see, one, how charisma doesn't really translate across a screen. Mm-hmm. you have to be in person. And otherwise, to see how people do fall for that, how people are really intelligent, really have everything going for them, they're educated, they should have, you know, that they fall for a line that is really tenuous at best. And that's something that I want to get to the bottom of. I wanted to find out that. And yeah, so I researched on the hoof for that one. Mm-hmm. And very, very interesting it was.
Mm. Yeah, it shows. One of my favorite characters in this book was Ellie Cooper. She goes by EC a lot in the book, and it's Amanda's transcriber. I think you were also a journalist, too. Did you ever have a transcriber or work with a transcriber?
I never had a transcriber because I had to transcribe all my own stuff. And if anyone is listening who has ever worked as a transcriber, it's really boring. However interesting what you're listening to is, transcribing it is really dull. So Ellie counteracts that in the novel by making her own comments and letting us know exactly what she thinks and letting Amanda know exactly what she thinks about her every step of the way.
And she gets more and more comfortable telling Amanda what she thinks as the book goes on. And
she definitely builds her own role. Yes. And she did that quite naturally as I was writing that first draft.
Oh.
Ellie was never meant to be a main character, but she inserted herself into every single transcription and she became quite a big character at the end.
She really did. And I looked for her parentheses and italics throughout the book because I really liked her comments. And, you know, a lot of it was like, Amanda, I think you're recording this without this person's permission. You know, Amanda, you really ate those fries up quite quickly, you know, like that.
And this is why you don't outline, because you never know the kind of magic you can find.
That is
exactly
true.
Yeah, but you're totally right there, Dave. That is why you don't know what's hiding beneath the surface of your idea.
Yeah, you got to let these characters speak to you
when you let them breathe and let them speak. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So speaking of letting them breathe, so we have Amanda and Oliver now, you know, Oliver, another journalist, and they're forced to work together. They have just a really funny repartee. Oliver accuses her of using email templates like it's 2001, where they, did you have a lot of fun writing for them as well? It sounds like you had a lot of fun writing this book.
I loved writing them. Well, the double act that they form was my main... This is my first springboard really into this, because I'd written a huge ensemble novel with The Appeal. Mm-hmm. I'd written a first person novel with The Twyford Code, and I wanted to do something different. So I thought, yeah, it'd be great to have a double act, and particularly a male female double act would be really good. So yeah, that was something that informed the whole novel, and it was lovely to write them, to give them a history, but not to reveal that till much later. And to have them bounce off each other, because they're both equally driven. They're very different people. But something they share is their drive, and their drive to find the truth. And it was a real delight to explore that equation, really equal drive, completely different personalities. So I love them.
Yeah, they were so snarky with one another, too. And EC, you know, Ellie's like, you should check in with him. And she's like, he's fine.
Oh yeah, when really he's taken seriously quite a lot of the cult.
He's not okay. We should check.
He's not okay.
Speaking of which, there's four people in here who seem to believe that they are archangels, or believe that they were archangels. And you name them Gabriel, Michael, Amaya, and Raphael. And I was kind of curious. Did you do any research into angels at all? You must have.
I did. Yes, yeah. I did. Quite a bit. And also people who do believe in angels or do believe in these powers that inform life here on Earth. Because I don't dismiss anything. I think that's an interesting belief.
Really fascinating. Yeah,
and, belief is a very powerful thing. You know, in The Wizard of Oz, when the Scarecrow, he's not given intelligence, he's given a degree. That tells him he's clever, and that's it changes his belief in himself, not at the actual fact. So belief is such a powerful pointer to human behavior. So yeah, I looked into angels and who the angels are. I mean, there's a whole soap opera going on up there with the angels, and there's a hierarchy between them. There's wars between them. You know, there's all sorts going on that. I feel like the Greek gods, I suppose.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? And I'd never heard of Elmaya. I've never heard of that one. That
no, Elmaya. Yeah, it's a doer. It's a doer angel.
Oh, okay.
It's I don't think angels can be either he or she. I think
they're
androgynous.
Non-binary, yeah.
Yes, non-binary, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But Elmaya is a doer, a facilitator of an angel.
Interesting. Very interesting. I'm also kind of curious, you know, you've had a lot of different careers. They all seem to be involved with writing. But you've pivoted throughout your life to different things. I think like a journalist, speechwriter, I was looking up a magazine editor. We've talked about the playwriting and the screenwriting. Are you someone who gets bored? Are you looking for change, or does
she can't even write the same? She can't even write the same kind of book. So clearly, I think so.
Absolutely true. I look for change now, but I haven't always. My career as a journalist, I was writing for magazines in the beauty sector. It's a tiny little sector, which meant that I was writing about bubble bath for 15 years. Wow. So while I say I do like change now, I did manage to, write about a really tiny little sector for a very long time. And I have to say, most people burned out of that sector in 2 years, but I stayed for 15 writing about shaving foam. So, but now, maybe that's why. Maybe now I'm fighting against that, because I do set myself that task. Every novel has to be different.
Wow.
Not only especially from the previous one, but ideally from all of them that have gone before.
That's like impressive.
Always different, always something new.
It makes it tough for yourself.
I like to think experimental.
Yeah, I can see that.
Give us your best exfoliating tip. What do you got for us, Janice?
Exfoliating tip. Look for a very fine grain and move in circles. So you're very fine, like sand. And so you can get some very big salt-like exfoliants, which are great. But if you're looking for facial exfoliant, small grain and circular movements.
Small grain.
That's my tip. Hot tip.
Okay, I like that. So I've been just going to the beach and grabbing a handful of sand and rub. So I've been doing it wrong this whole time.
Tear the skin. That's really funny. Well, I mean, that type of journalism is usually traditionally that's what women could get, right? Mm. That's what women. That's what we do. That's mm-hmm. what women. Yeah, like I think we talked to Laura Lippman, who in the States, who worked for the Baltimore Sun, and it, you know, there's certain things that women reporters are given sometimes.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was on the one hand, yes, it was quite a female niche, but it was again quite a nice place for a young woman to be, as mm-hmm. I was at the time, because you get to see an industry that is completely female focused.
Yeah.
It's often run a lot by women. And for women. Yeah. And that's quite a nice sort of positive, empowering kind of thing. Whatever you think about the beauty industry, it makes people feel better.
Yes.
Yeah, about absolutely. Themselves all the mm-hmm. time. And again, belief, very, very powerful. Mm-hmm. And I felt it was a good thing and a force for good for most of the time.
Yeah, love that.
Well,
yeah.
Speaking of women and feminism, I was reading on your Goodreads that you wrote a feminist Shakespearean stage comedy called Netherbard. I'm very curious about this, Janice. What can you tell me about this?
I did indeed. I wrote Netherbard. Netherbard is a short play about three actors, female actors, who are playing the witches in Macbeth.
Okay.
Oh. And they're bemoaning their tiny parts and the fact they can't get great parts. Accidentally, one day in rehearsal, they cast a spell that transports them to King Lear playing the daughters.
Oh,
and they have to get back to Macbeth by going through all of Shakespeare's plays, playing all the lead roles. So they thought they wanted the lead roles, so they've got them.
They got it.
It's a quite mad. It's not true to life. It's quite a mad, funny play. It's great. I wanted to do something great for female actors because when you put a lot of plays on, you realize that men do get a lot of the great roles.
Yes, and, yes they do. They get the meat.
Wanted to redress that balance just a tiny bit.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I love that. Boy, that'd be great for your girls too.
That'd be amazing. Yeah, it could really.
I noticed
something
with high school drama, it's mostly females. It is. Mm-hmm. A lot of very strong female actors, not as many male actors for whatever reason in high school. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that it changes as, you know, roles are given out in the real world.
Yeah. All right, Janice, it is now time for our segment that we call Quick Six. And you're going to need two passcodes for this, so I'll send them to you. These are six quick questions, which we find out just a little bit more about you. Here we go. What is
far away
the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Oh, I really loved Ozark.
Such a good show.
Yeah, I was a bit late to the party, but I loved it.
Yeah,
so
did
good.
The whole lot.
Oh, you did all at once?
Oh,
yeah.
That's
great.
Oh, that's dark. That is dark.
That is a really dark place to put yourself in, but it's so good. So good. And Jason Bateman, all the acting in that is so good, but I've always loved Jason Bateman. He's so fun to watch.
And Laura Linney.
And Laura Linney, of course. Yeah, she's amazing too. Yeah.
What fictional world or place would you like to visit?
Narnia.
Oh, yeah.
It's from my childhood.
Absolutely.
It sounds a bit... I do tend to regard old wardrobes with a kind of mysterious longing.
Yeah. Step inside. Nice. Yeah, see what's back there.
How about this, Janice? Give us one of your favorite movies of all time. You've already mentioned The Wizard of Oz, so you can't say that. I'm going to take that off. That's stricken from the record. You can't say The Wizard of Oz.
Okay. This is Spinal Tap. Do you know that one?
Spinal Tap.
Yeah. Love it.
This goes to 11,
so
of
much.
Course. Yes. What
I could watch that time after time after time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. How about one of your favorite books?
Oh, that's now you're asking.
Harder.
One of my favorite books of all time. I'm going to say Don Quixote.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because it's so old. It's like contemporary of Shakespeare. If you read it, you'll just be laughing cover to cover. It's so funny. What made people laugh 400 years ago? It could still makes us laugh today.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. Yeah.
Have you always responded well to comedy? Do you seek out? Now you say you're a big fan of true crime, but I know you like humor as well. Do you that when you seek out, oh, you know, you mentioned Spinal Tap, that is clearly hilarious.
Yeah.
So do you seek out comedy? Well, you are like Ozark as well. It sounds like you just like.
Yeah, I like really dark things, mm-hmm. and I like light comedy things. I think it's somewhere in the middle where I don't care much for. It's like it's one extreme or another. It's all or nothing.
Yeah.
Because my everything is polarized between the really dark and the really light. Yeah, comedy means a lot to me. And darkness. All my stage stuff that I wrote two full-length plays, lots of short plays. They're all comedies, all of them. Huh. And one of them was even a farce, which is a real extreme comedy. Yeah, but most things I write for the screen have been dark.
Mm. I love a good. Theatrical farce. Nothing like the slamming doors and the stomping around on stage. It's so much fun to watch when it's done well.
And they're really difficult. They're hard to stage, as you'll know. They're difficult for the actors, for the director, and they're hard to write as well, which makes them more of a challenge and more of an achievement if you get to do them.
Interesting.
How about this? Now, Janice, you, as someone with a background in theater, I'm going to expect a positive answer to this question. Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Yes. Now, what's it called? I think it's called, look it up. Is it What a Feeling? Is it called
What a Feeling? Oh, yeah, What a Feeling. Dancing on the Ceiling, Lionel Richie. Is that it?
No.
Dancing on the Ceiling?
No, it's not that one. Okay. It's by, I'm looking it up on my phone.
Flashdance, What a Feeling?
What a Feeling. Yeah, it's from Flashdance.
Yes, Irene Cara.
Flashdance, that's the one. It's from Flashdance, that one.
Oh, that's a great one,
You can belt it out, and you don't really have to be in tune, or at least that's what I think.
I like that. That's the first Flashdance answer that we've
got. Yeah, we haven't had that one before.
I have to listen to that song. I don't remember that song very well.
Anytime you can make a movie successful based on a woman who's a welder and...
and a dancer. That's true.
And a dancer.
It's amazing.
Like we all are.
Yeah. The last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
I'm currently reading, well, I get the chance to read books before they're published, and I'm reading a book called The Puzzle Wood by, and I'm going to have to look her up again because it's in my head. Let me know. She also wrote another historical crime book. She also wrote another one called The Leviathan. I'm just going to look that up so I get her name.
Puzzle Wood.
The Puzzle Wood, and it's really good. Who wrote The Leviathan? Let's have a look. I hope this is interesting for your listeners, listening to me looking
we'll
something
edit,
up on my phone.
Don't worry about this. We'll edit
it's
this
fascinating.
Part out.
Rosie Andrews. Okay, here we go. It's called The Puzzle Wood by Rosie Andrews. And it's historical crime, and it's very, very creepy.
Ooh. I'm
reading that at the moment.
Very good.
So I read before I go to sleep, and it really creeps me out. This one's really... I go, and I turn the light off, and it's like, oh...
Now, Laura has to switch to another book.
I have
she gets
to switch.
Out.
I'll switch to like something innocuous sometimes.
I understand. I get that. Yeah.
Well, Janice, listen, we loved your book, The Mysterious Case of the Alperton Angels. And I'll be looking for that Shakespearean feminist comedy. That sounds really good.
Yeah.
And it's been a delight talking
to you. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Janice. Have a good rest of your day.
Oh, thank you. Thank you to you. And thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, of course.
I could have talked to you all day.
Yeah, we could talk to you all day, too.
Yeah, definitely.
But we can't.
I'm still in awe of what you did with Alperton Angels. It was amazing.
Oh, thank you for reading. Thank you.
Yeah.
It was a joy to write as well. So that's lovely to hear.
Awesome.
I could see that. Yeah.
Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Dave.
Bye.
And Laura.
Bye.
The Inside Flip.
All right, so let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews
and a brand new walk up. So we now I know we teased this last. We teased this the last 2 weeks, but
maybe,
we finally
maybe longer.
I feel like it's been longer.
Yeah, maybe it has. Yeah. We finally have our new walk up music. So let's start with
Laura Medicus.
She comes from Silver Spoon, Golden Rule, private school, never miss Sunday church.
Nice, right?
Very nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, now, what is this?
This is called Wondering Why by the Red Clay Strays. And they are a new band from Alabama.
And I don't know what happened, but it should have had a bone.
I've not seen them live, but they got a great sound.
I do. I like that sound. I need to get out and see them.
Yeah, get an Americana sound that I really dig. So check them out.
All right, very nice.
Yeah, it's my favorite song from them.
All right, that's a good one.
So my book for the week is called Between the World and Me. By Ta-Nehisi, no, sorry, I knew I'd get this wrong. Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Oh,
I had
sure.
to look
okay,
up
yeah.
how to pronounce his name because mm-hmm. yep. it's not quite spelled like that. Right. So this is from, and he's pretty well known. I feel like he's a journalist for The Atlantic for many years. He was, and mm-hmm. Has written all kinds of pieces for like the New York Times and places like that. So this is from 2015 and it's new to me and it completely rocked my world.
Oh, wow.
So this is a book I will reread. I am not a big rereader of things.
Right.
But this is one that the writing is so powerful that I feel like I need to reread it. And maybe I might look for it audio, like an audio book of this to see how it's read. So this is nonfiction. And Coates wrote this as a letter to his son. And it's absolutely brilliant. So it's almost 10 years old. It reads like a classic. Like when you read it, you're like, oh, I get this. Okay. This is an important book. So this is a book written by a black man to his 15-year-old black son. Mm. And it's filled with fear for his son and his son's physical safety, his bodily safety in this world. And it's... honest thoughts about being a black man in America. So it's filled with experiences from growing up in Baltimore and also the really amazing experience he had at Howard University, which I think is in DC.
Yes, it is. Yep.
Yeah.
HBCU.
HBCU. Mm-hmm. So the book's also permeated with just a profound sadness for Americans who believe themselves white. And that's the author's words, not mine.
Right.
Which is us, right. Who he also refers to as the Dreamers with a capital D. Mm.
So let's talk about how dangerous Baltimore is.
Oh, listen. Okay. So I'm going to skip ahead, but, he grew up in West Baltimore. Mm. He is a year younger than me. So I know, and you know, you guys know.
Sure.
Yep. I've lived in Baltimore.
What West Baltimore was like then. Yep.
And so West Baltimore is what? Mondawmin Mall. Does he like say specific areas?
Yeah, he does. And he talks about going to Mondawmin Mall. Yeah. And he went to, we played them in track. Woodlawn? Is it Woodlawn High School? He graduated from there.
So the thing with Baltimore is near Woodlawn, back in the day, like in the 20s, that used to be like one of the jazz like capitals of the world.
Oh.
Like Baltimore used to be big in the jazz scene. Louis Armstrong, you name it.
Yeah.
So within sight of Mondawmin Mall are like historical jazz clubs and stuff.
Oh.
But what happened is after the Great Depression, Baltimore never recovered. And a lot of inner cities, if you actually find, they didn't recover to the Great Depression. But how dangerous is Baltimore? Let me give you some statistics.
It's frightening.
Well, I think the population of Baltimore is less than like 500,000 now, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are something like 300 people murdered every year. Mm. So if you do the math, it's something like one out of every 1,750 residents is killed every single year.
Mm.
Wow.
Now, if you are black, that number goes up.
Yeah.
If you are a young black man, that number goes up.
Yeah.
So I mean, so you think about it, like you think about those odds and those statistics. And there's other cities too that are dangerous, but Baltimore City statistically
is
an extremely dangerous place.
And he tells about growing up in West Baltimore. And West Baltimore, also, if anyone's watched The Wire,
Baltimore. Well, look at my shirt, what I'm wearing
right
now.
That's right. You've got Yaphet Kotto.
Homicide life on the streets.
Well, West Baltimore was ruled by Avon Barksdale that The Wire detailed. Mm-hmm. And it's not a place to thrive in. You try to survive it, you know.
And it's true. And so I renovated houses in West Baltimore.
Mm.
And I can tell you stories there, some stories I won't tell.
My dad taught elementary school in West Baltimore Avon Barksdale. Yeah. They locked children up.
They would chain the doors.
Chained the doors
the
shut.
Yeah.
So that no one would come through with a gun and drugs.
And we would rent houses just outside of Baltimore.
Ugh.
And I would have moms call me, begging me, please, I'm trying to get my kids out of the inner city. Please rent this house to me, right? Because they just want to get their kids
out
of Baltimore City. And you know, and you feel for them. And like I would say in almost every case, there was no way like to make it work. But I mean, it is, yeah, I mean, I don't know like what adjectives to use, but it really is.
It's grim.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And so imagine growing up with that, and he's got, you know, he clearly made it, went to Howard, brilliant mind. And this is just a really powerful book. I absolutely loved it. And, you know, I found it illuminating. I think it's really important for anyone trying to understand race in America, especially right now when we're entering an election year, where there's a lot of talk about that from all sides. It's a book that was banned in South Carolina in 2023.
Oh, come on.
And it appears to be banned in other places now as well.
So he's doing something right.
He's doing something right. And yeah. You're right. Anytime you hear that, you're like, well, let's go see what this book's about. What don't they want me to know? You know,
right.
Why is this so dangerous? I'm going to say, read it for yourself. It's not toxic. It's not hate-filled, even though this writer has every reason to be hate-filled. It's not hate-filled at all. It's very heartfelt.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's good.
And it's also on, this is interesting, The Guardian, which is UK. It's on their list of the 100 best books of the 21st century.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
So, you know, West Baltimore, I found it, you know, just so fascinating, very moving. I was affected by, you know, his fear for his teenage son, his experience as a black man in America, which is something that clearly I can't understand, but I can try to understand it. You know what I mean? I guess I can understand it, but I haven't walked through that until I understand where he's been from. That's what I'm trying to say. So his writing is really strong. It's very poetic and it flows. I can't recommend it enough. And it's called Between the World and Me. Mm-hmm. And he won the MacArthur Genius Grant same year this book came out.
Yeah, I definitely want to read that book, you know, having taught in inner city and just being around and seeing the kinds of just the systemic racism.
Yes, that's what a lot of this book is about.
These kids and these adults face.
It's so, as a person who believes themselves white, to use his words.
Yeah.
Like, there is this dream, and he talks a lot about the dream, the suburban dream that we are all sold and we've been told that we can have.
Right.
And it's interesting to me, his take on it.
Well, and when you're in a classroom with children who are raised in this environment, you're just constantly reminded of white privilege and how we live with it and we deal with it and just how hard it is for them growing up. And anybody who is able to make it out, it's 100 times harder than it is for people who are white. So. That's a book that I definitely want to
It's fantastic.
Take a look at. All right, that book is recommended by Laura Medicus, and my book this week,
Dave Medicus. It's a
bonfire. Turn the lights out. Here's my wall. This is, if you don't know, this is a Childish Gambino, a.k.a. Donald Glover. This song. And this is anytime when Sylvia and I go anywhere in the truck, when she hops in my truck, this is we always put this song on and rock out to this song. No matter
you ever seen Atlanta? His show Atlanta?
I've not.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, gotta start on Community. We loved him on Community. Loved the show Atlanta. Check out that show.
Is that the music show, like the music dynasty?
No.
Oh, it's not.
No. Yeah. Although it is music, because he's a producer.
Right.
For a rapper.
His cousin was a rapper. Yeah.
There's some other show where it's like a family. And they're like in the music industry, but they're like gangsters in the music industry. And I think it also takes place in Atlanta.
That is a show on ABC, so you would know about that because that's a network show. We're speaking of a show.
This is a dramedy. I would call it a dramedy. Okay. It's like a half-hour dramedy. It's very
really
unusual.
Very artistic. Very unusual. And really, really good. Anyway, so...
Good song, Dave.
Yeah, thank you
good
very
choice.
Much. Thank you very much. I love that song. So my book this week is an oldie, but it is a goodie, and I discovered this author, and this author's name is David Rosenfeld, when I read about he's got a new book coming out now, and that's not the book I'm going to talk about. His new book, and I saw that it was described as a, quote, courtroom cozy. I said, well,
oh, yeah. It was so weird when I was like, what are you reading? I'm reading legal cozy.
Courtroom cozy. I love cozies. I love legal thrillers. How great would it be to have them combined? Listen, it's like peanut butter and marshmallow cream together. So I did a little digging and found out his new book is the 29th. Yeah, you're making a face. There's the.
I don't know about peanut butter and marshmallow cream.
Oh, yeah, it's a fluffernutter.
Oh, the fluffernutter.
Yeah, the fluffernutter.
Okay.
So his new book is number 29 in the series. So I said, well, let me go back and read the first one to see if this is something that I'm into. And that book is titled Open and Shut. It was written in 2002, and I absolutely love this book. It's funny. It definitely fits the bill as a cozy mystery, and there are lots of great courtroom scenes, which, of course, you got to have a cantankerous judge that everybody calls Hatchet behind his back. And there is also a golden retriever who's an ancillary character. In fact, the author operates on his Goodreads bio. He says, I write novels and own 27 dogs. Somehow it works. And he operates a foundation that rescues dogs.
Oh, he really does.
And finds homes for them. Oh, yes. And many of them golden. So he loves, Andrew, you'll be happy to know.
And report came out as the number one breed in Colorado.
Is it really?
Oh. Most states, the Chihuahua is the number one breed.
I had no idea.
What?
The Chihuahua?
Yeah, not in Colorado.
Wow, good for us.
Yeah, thank you.
Colorado. I have a lot of clients with Goldens.
Chihuahua is number two in Colorado.
Of course it is. So this book, Open and Shut, is told from the first person point of view, and our hero, and what a great voice he has, is defense attorney Andy Carpenter, who, much to the chagrin of his esteemed and well-respected lawyer father, Andy's always got some kind of wacky shtick and hijinks to engage in the courtroom that might be fun to watch, but always gets him into hot water with the judge for his shenanigans and his willingness to kind of shake things up. Well, one day his father receives some new information on an old case that his father worked on, and he tells his son to look into it. The case concerns a black man who was sentenced to death for killing a white woman. And it was his father who prosecuted the case and put this man on death row, where he's been for 7 years. It is now up to Andy to start digging around, and based on some new revelations, he's able to get another trial going for this man. Suddenly, Andy's father dies, and Andy finds out that his dad is worth over $20 million owing to a mysterious payment from years ago in his past. And while cleaning out his father's belongings, he comes across a photograph of his dad with three other men who are all now very successful and very wealthy. And when these men deny that it is them in the picture, Andy gets suspicious. What I loved about this book is the voice of Andy. He's very funny. He's got a lot of shtick going in. He's quick with a quip or a sarcastic comment, and he's not afraid to stick his nose where he shouldn't in the name of finding out the truth. There are lots of twists and revelations along the way. And, of course, the courtroom scenes have everything you want in a good legal thriller. I also enjoyed trying to figure out along the way how this photograph from years ago fit into things. The mystery is very engaging. And now the best thing is that I now have 28 more books to read to get to 29 in the series. So I really enjoyed this one. It is Open and Shut. It is by David Rosenfeld, and that is recommended by... All right, Andrew.
Andrew Dowd. This bed is on
fire with passion and love. James.
That's right. There you go.
Laid by James.
Yes, I love this song.
It's a great song.
And that's part of it is...
I love James.
I listened to hundreds of like 80s and 90s songs.
This was a good one.
But this is just such...
I like that Sit Down Next to Me by him. Or by the band, I guess.
Well, and it's funny, because I looked these up. I was looking up One Hit Wonders, but none of their other songs came close to this in popularity.
Yeah.
Like, not even close. And I looked up other One Hit Wonders, and it's just amazing how so many groups, like, they have one song.
Yeah.
It's
like I know. And then, I like this and another one of their songs. Mm. But I love James. I love their song. I had their CD. Yeah.
Oh, Andrew, you've touched upon a big fan.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I don't know if I can picture the album cover. It's him in a strapless kind of dress,
right,
eating a banana. And I believe he's wearing combat boots.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, interesting.
So, but no, a fantastic song.
That's a great song.
It is a great song.
Good one.
So, You know, speaking of revealing, my book this week is Magic's Mantle by Bruce Centaur. Now, we have talked about...
Yes, speaking of revealing.
We have talked about cover art.
Oh.
And you should look up this book.
Oh, dear.
And Dave, I actually
have... All right,
have,
let's take a look at it.
I can take
What's
a look.
What's it called again? Magic Mantle?
Magic's Mantle.
Magic's Mike?
Mantle.
Magic Mike and,
Magic's
and the Mantle,
Mantle
of Death.
By Bruce Centaur. S-E-N-T-A-R.
All right, I've got it here. Whoa! Okay.
Yeah, you'll have to put a picture of this on the...
people can look up for their own. I'm not going to point on the...
Oh,
no, go ahead
that is not that. What I thought I'd say.
Oh, no.
That is not what I thought I'd say.
So
she is a very... What was that?
Gee, I wonder why you picked this book up, Andrew.
Quite the décolletage for a suffragette.
Yeah. So it is like... This is like... This is probably...
Wow.
Like every guy's view of like... you know, it's... you know, I...
It's a cartoon woman. She's got
okay. Well, let them look it up.
Okay.
We'll look it up. Yeah. So yeah. But so it's interesting because we've talked about cover art, and even authors have even admitted
it is interesting.
Sometimes cover art misses the mark.
Oh yeah.
You know.
I wonder what Bruce Centaur feels about.
Yeah, yeah. And I almost want it, like, if there would be a discussion.
I mean, do they want women to read the book?
On this cover art.
I'm guessing no.
Yeah.
Is it like a male fantasy type of book?
To a certain extent.
Okay, yeah. Because, I mean, women have Fabio, right?
Exactly.
We'll have male
and I would
stuff
call this,
like that.
This book is sort of Wheel of Time-esque.
Okay.
Now, if you know Wheel of Time, I believe it is Brandon Sanderson.
Oh, okay.
It's an epic movie out there. There's, like, the main character's Rand. He's a powerful magician. And he has, like, you know, all these dalliances with women and stuff like that. I mean, he is just like, you know, so it's sort of like a,
I don't know that I've ever seen that type of book marketed at men. I've only seen the romances marketed towards women.
Yeah. Mm. And I wouldn't say, I mean, certainly that cover got my attention.
Yeah.
Right?
Would have gotten my attention, too.
Sure. And I get anybody's attention.
And since a fantasy book, it is not... Like, I wouldn't say it's appropriate for young kids. I mean, most of the content is normal.
21 plus?
But there is a few, you know...
18 and over?
Explicit scenes in the book, yeah. And so basically the book is book one of Ard's Oath. And of course, Ard, short for Arden, is the main character of the book. Now,
is that the woman who graces the cover?
He's the guy. And the book actually never says specifically which woman graces the cover. And I think it's the character Irwin is the character. And we'll talk a bit about her. And so, but the book doesn't actually, like, it talks about her physical characteristics a little bit, but it doesn't really describe her in terms of, like, painting her in the picture. So it doesn't, like, you know, I want to say this book doesn't objectify women.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't say she looks like this and
like
describes her looking like the person on the cover.
Okay.
Right?
It's fine.
Yeah. So anyways.
It doesn't bother me.
Ard is the main character. He is an orphan. He lives in the outskirts of this kingdom. And the story is that when he was a baby, and they don't say like how old, but he was a baby. His dad showed up. His dad was basically burned. He was badly damaged, right? Powerful magician. And he basically... gave his son to this couple in this remote village, right? They didn't know him. They didn't know who he was. He said, please take care of my son. And he left. And he left a medallion that could have identified who this man was. And so Ard grew up in this remote village, never knowing anything about his parents, but always wanting to know, like, who am I? And he wore the medallion so much that it got worn away. That you couldn't even really see what was on it. Now, he remembers what was on it, but you can't actually see it because he's worn it for everything. But it's the only attachment he has to who he really is. Now, this is a kingdom with magic, and when mages have shown up, he's tried to show them the medallion saying, you know, I'm an orphan, that my dad... This
do you
is
recognize
from
it?
Yeah, do you recognize it? But the mages are so arrogant, like, he's like, you know, I risk my life just talking to them, right? I mean, that's the kind of world this is. So... Ard had hoped that he would become a magician, that he would come into his powers, and that he's almost 18 years old and it hasn't happened yet, right? I mean, because if he didn't come into his bad powers, wouldn't really have much of a book now,
no,
would we?
Right.
No.
Would we?
No, indeed.
I wonder if he's going to be the most powerful of all magicians.
Yeah, yeah. So anyways, he's an innkeeper. And so he's running an inn with this other woman.
Okay.
And right, and they're not a couple or anything like that. And so basically, he had a girl sweetheart. Her name was Irwin, and he was in love with Irwin. And 3 years previous, she came into her magic powers, and she basically left to go to the Enclave to learn magic.
Oh.
Right? Now, there are different types of magics in this kingdom, but they're mages, and then there are what they call anchors. And so what this book says is you can use magic, but when you use magic, you get energies that are built up in your system, and they have to be drained. And you have to have a relationship with an anchor that to basically like drain the excess energy into them, right? And so Irwin is an anchor, and you know, and so she comes into, so it just so happens that after 3 years, she comes back into town, and as soon as Ard sees Irwin back into town with a group of mages, he literally heads for the door and wants to get the heck out of it. He doesn't want to see her. He doesn't want to talk to her. It's just too painful for him. And so that's how the book starts out. Now,
what do you call a group of mages?
Well, and so
maybe like a majesty.
In this case, I think it was two mages, and then it was four anchors is basically who was in the group. Yeah, yeah, yeah. As far as I don't know. Yeah, a group. I call it a group of mages is what I call it. Yeah.
A Copperfield.
Yeah, what not going to go there.
A Copperfield.
Yeah. So basically, he goes on the outskirts of town. He's trying to get away. So, of course, he starts getting attacked. That's the long and short of it. And he has a couple groups that want to obviously kill and obliterate him. And he has a couple factions that want to save him. And because, of course, he's now... And they said, oh, we're all here because something momentous is going to happen. A mage is going to come into his powers. And, of course, does... Ard come into his powers shortly before his 18th birthday? Yes, he does.
Oh, boy.
Now, is Ard's magic different than other people's magic?
I think it might be.
Yes. Yes, it is. Uh-huh. Now, so the magic in this world is spheres. You've got like one sphere, two spheres, three spheres. But Ard turns out to be the only living four-sphere mage. Mm. And of course, there's mystery like, what can a four-sphere mage do? You know, and so basically it's like, well, you know, and so they defeat the attack, and they're like, well, you can stay in the town, but your village is going to continue to be attacked and your friends are going to all die, or you can come with us to the capital, to the Enclave, to learn magic. And so, of course, that's what he does. Now, is it a quiet, quick trip to the capital? Or basically, is everybody out to try and kill him and capture him?
Yeah, you want this four-sphere magician.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a mystery, and so he's learning his powers. So it is a coming-of-age story. He's learning his powers. He's learning who he is. And there are some heartfelt moments in the book. Ard is a flippant character. He is smart. He is cunning, but he uses his flippancy as sort of a cover. And, you know, he gets into basically all kinds of shenanigans. And so, you know, it is a good book. Like I said, it is Wheel of Time-esque. Mm. I'm already basically reading the second book in the series.
Nice.
There's a lot of intrigue. It is a pretty fast paced book. Like the action, you know, pretty much occurs. And there is, like I said, I wouldn't recommend this for anybody that's under 18.
Is the second cover kind of like that or no?
It is. Okay. So you look, but it's different. And I think the cover on the second book is actually what do you call it? A god.
Oh.
Like I think that's
a dude.
No, another woman.
Oh, it's another woman.
A god can be a woman, Laura.
Oh, I guess so. I usually think of them as goddesses. Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Come on.
And so let me tell you the name of the second book is called Noble Bearings.
Okay.
Ard's Oath, Book 2.
Okay.
And it is also, an interesting cover. Not as, you know.
Oh, I mean, it's still provocative.
It is. It really is. Yes.
This guy. Oh, I'm looking at all of his. Yeah. I would say the magic's... No. There's one called Mana Master.
Yeah.
That I would say maybe is a little more overboard.
Oh, a little...
Oh, they... Wait. Oh. Wow. Yeah. I mean, you could...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, cover art.
Okay, probably saving supervillains would be the most graphic of his.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. So You'll have to look it up. But the author is, the book is,
I mean, if
Magic's
you want,
Mantle by Bruce Centaur. You have to look at some wonderful cover.
Maybe if you want to get savings. Your heterosexual teenage son into reading.
Yeah, this is a great way to get him into reading. You're going to hook him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am. I'll have to show my 14-year-old son this book and see what he thinks what he thinks about it.
Well, the book got 4 stars on Goodreads. The cover got 5. So, I mean, it's
which averages out to 4.5. Exactly. Yeah.
That's really funny.
All right. Well, that book is recommended by
Andrew Dowd. Audiobook of the week.
And my pick this week is another oldie but a goodie. And this is somebody that I was not really familiar with. And, Anthony Bourdain. Andrew, I don't know if you've ever watched any of his shows.
So we're big foodies.
Right. I was going to ask you about that.
So Katie is a huge fan of Anthony Bourdain.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, he had his demons.
Yeah. And if you want to read about his demons and hear all about them, I would recommend checking out this book from 2000. It's very, very popular. So many of you out there may have already read it. It was new to me. Mm-hmm. And it was my introduction to...
Did he read it?
The world of Anthony Bourdain. He did read it.
Yeah,
he is an exceptional reader. He is fantastic. It is called Kitchen Confidential. Mm-hmm. And it's basically his story of how he got his start and his life in the restaurant business. It's absolutely fat. Now, if you ever want to think that your job is stressful, I would recommend picking up this book and reading it and saying, well, my job is nowhere near as stressful as what this guy is dealing with. As the head chef in a New York City restaurant.
Crazy.
Goodness. Great. And he does. There's a chapter where he goes through his day minute by minute and breaks down exactly what's going on and every little thing that he has to deal with. I mean, the cooking, he's in the kitchen cooking the meals, dealing with his staff, handling deliveries. And it just goes on and on and on. And when you say, well, there can't possibly be more, there's more. And then it's like, okay, well, no wonder this guy had a massive drug problem. And there's no wonder this guy had some serious. And there's a guy, one of the restaurants was clearly owned by the mafia, and he's working for the mafia. It is fascinating story. There's another whole chapter, and he talks also about his time in the Culinary Institute and how he cut his teeth there, which is really interesting. But there's a whole chapter where he just describes his hands, and he's detailing every little cut and every scratch and every ding where and how he injured himself on the job over the years, and how some certain fingers don't work the way they used to from chopping or peeling potatoes or whatever it is. Justin, absolutely. I was enthralled by this book. And really, you know, I haven't really looked at his TV shows. You know, Laura and I aren't huge. Of course, every time we go on a trip, we come back, and the first thing that Andrew says, what'd you eat? I always feel bad because
we're the opposite of foodies, I would say. We're like, oh, we had a peanut butter sandwich for dinner.
We went to a grocery store and got some cheeses and some
and then
meats
we felt
and
disappointed
stuff.
And then we went to sleep.
We're out seeking adventures, I guess. Our energy is focused in other
areas. As I told Andrew last week, we're cheap also.
Frugal. Absolutely frugal. So the book is Kitchen Confidential. Let's take a listen to a clip read by Anthony Bourdain.
I'm usually the guy they call in as some high-profile operation when the first chef turns out to be a psychopath or a mean megalomaniacal drunk. This book is about street-level cooking and its practitioners. Line cooks are the heroes. I've been hustling a nicely paid living out of this life for a long time, most of it in the heart of Manhattan, the bigs. So I know a few things. I've still got a few moves left in me. Of course, there's every possibility this book could finish me in the business. There will be horror stories. Heavy drinking, drugs, screwing in the dry goods area, unappetizing revelations about bad food handling and unsavory industry-wide practices. Talking about why you probably shouldn't order fish on a Monday, why those who favor well-done get the scrapings from the bottom of the barrel, and why seafood frittata is not a wise brunch selection, won't make me any more popular with potential future employers.
Audiobook of the week.
All right, there you go. That is episode 240 in the books. Thank you so much for joining us. And we say thank you to Janice Hallett for hopping on. Check out her new book, The Mysterious Case of the Alperton Angels. Tune in next week to see if Andrew still has a job. And
he will next week.
Oh, that's true. Well,
maybe being the
who knows? You never know.
HR might get restless.
Andrew might get restless.
That's right. My name is Dave Medicus. See you next time.
Adios.
Excelsior.
I get it.